plastic tape, you've got pretty much a an excellent bond, and you're preventing migration of just about anything. The good part of it is when you're ready to disconnect, just take a sharp blade, slice right down the middle, and everything comes off in one swift rip off, and there's basically no residue at all. Back to that into RSO.
Thank you very much, Frank. That sounds like a darn good solution. But I'm going to pass it back to you in a minute for you to tell us how expensive that tape is. I've seen a number of really good riggers use a kind of red stretchable tape that they put on first on connectors, and they put black electrical tape on top of that. That red stretchable tape does a very good job of sealing. Also, when you put the black tape on top, many people in a hurry will end the black tape by pulling on it until it snaps. I recommend you do not do that. When you come to the end of the wrapping, the last little bit of black tape that you're wrapping on top, cut it with scissors or a knife. Do not pull it until it snaps. When you pull it until it snaps, that end of the tape has been stretched. That portion will eventually relax and come back to its normal length, and it will peel away the glue in that section when it does it. Therefore, you end up with a one-inch tail where it is not taped down, and now when it's flapping in the breeze and the weather and the ice and everything else, that tape will slowly unravel itself. If you don't want the black tape to unravel itself, do not pull it until it snaps at the end. Cut the last bit of it at the end of the roll. Cut it with scissors or a knife. Do not stretch it. That's my opinion, because I've watched a lot of those unravel. Mel, I know you want to add something to this. K2KEY, H2RIW.
This is K2KEY. Well, I'll tell you what I've had a lot of success with. The telephone company uses, in fact, that product with a joint cable. They slip a boot over it, and then they use a heat-shrinkable boot as black, and it's heavy material. And it's amazing when that boot is shrinks onto the cable, locks onto the cable. The seal is immensely tight. I didn't believe how tight that is, but it almost looks like it's digging into the cable where, you know, between the, where it wraps itself, you know, it shrinks around the connector portion and the cable behind it. But it's amazing that heat shrinkable stuff, that this black stuff, and it's heavy, heavy quality. I mean, it's not like you would say like, like a tape, thin like a tape. It's got wall thickness, I don't know if that product, how it's sold, but it seems to really do the job. I mean, you can use a propane torch or anything, you know, with heat gun or whatever, but I say when that shrinks on, and oh yes, as far as coax seal, yeah, they tell you with coax seal, do not tape first and put coax seal on top of it. You've got to put the coax seal first, but I wonder if that maybe heat shrinking tubing may be the answer, over.
You know, when it comes to the really high class connectors made by Andrew and other companies, some of them come with a piece of black heat shrink tubing that's made for just the right diameter for that connector and the cable that the connector is going on. And there's a gooey substance on the inside of this heat shrink heavy walled tubing. And I believe they have a date code on them too, because the goo on the inside, if it hasn't been activated by being put onto a connector and shrunk down in a certain length of time, like about a year, the goo inside starts hardening and it may not give you as good a seal as you would like. There have been flea markets I see where people are selling these heavy walled heat shrink tubing in various diameters with the goo on the inside of the heat shrink tubing, intended for weather sealing connectors. And it does a very good job. And I believe it's a pretty rugged substance that you can use a propane torch on it. Very few of us have got the electrical power to run a real heat gun at the top of the tower. The best we can do is haul up a Burnsomatic up there, and even that's a little bit troublesome. I've got a special harness that I add to my climbing belt where I can hang on my Burnsomatic, and I've got a soldering iron tip that goes on the Burnsomatic, so in theory I have the ability to do soldering at the top of the tower. But on a really windy day, that's not an easy thing to do. and you'd be using the kind of a Burns-O-Matic that's got a push-button switch where it self-ignites. You try to light a Burns-O-Matic with a soldering iron tip on the top of a tower on a windy day, and you're going to be using a lot of strong, salty language. Because you're putting out a lot of matches, and the wind will be blowing out the flame quite often. So, getting heat at the top of the tower. I guess there's ways you can do it with now modern-day battery-operated nickel-cadmium or nickel-metal hydride-type battery-type things, you know, your portable drill motors and things like that. Anybody have any further comments on weather sealing of their connectors on the top of the tower? Give us a call at us right now, K2RAW in the Fed. Okay, Frank recognized. Your audio was very low that time, Frank. Maybe you were talking into the back of the mic. You got it, Frank.
Okay, Dick. I'll talk a little louder. Hope I don't wake up the family. You asked before about the price on that silicone tape. The last roll I purchased was approximately $7.95. However, given the price increase on gasoline and food and just about everything else, if you're...
Kilo Charlie 2 here, and you're still listening.
Okay, so $7.95 is what you paid last time, Frank, and yes, maybe it's going to be a little bit more expensive now. Kilo Charlie 2 Sierra something. Did you have a question or a comment you want to make to the Technical Net, which meets here every Sunday night from 8 o'clock until roughly midnight? Go right ahead, sir. And if you have a question or a comment, please start off with your name. My name is Dick. Okay, that was Kilo Charlie 2 Sierra blank blank. And maybe, like he said, he's just listening. I think we've gone down the list of everyone who signed in with a question or a comment. But let me pass it around for one more try. And if Paul's around, he's going to tell us about the launch of the space shuttle that took place this weekend. So, anyone else, and or Paul, give me your call letters right now. K2RIW.
W2MKB.
2HVR.
Okay, MKV and HVR in that order. Mr. MKV, start up with your name, sir, and then your question or comment.
The name is Mitch, W2MKV, and there's an easy way to get the best of both worlds and not, spend a fortune looking for parts. It's all Home Depot stuff, and it was mentioned in the previous hints and kinks in QST. You basically buy a 2 or 3 inch piece of flexible PVC, the clear stuff, and you slip that onto the cable before you put the connector on. And then, you, as you're connecting it and you finish soldering it, you seal it with clear silicone rubber, and then you pull the clear section up over the cable and its mating connector, and then fill that with clear silicone rubber. Once it cures, take your knife and cut away the clear so it will cure all the way through and through, and now you have a see-through, weatherproof connection that you can actually see if you arc or if any corrosion occurs under there. And once it, if you ever have to replace it, a simple box cutter knife or putty knife will separate it into its components.
Interesting, Mitch. Do you happen to know approximately what month or what year that was in hints and kinks of, I think you're saying, QST magazine? What's your guess as to how far back that was indicated, Mitch? Go ahead.
I think it was within the last 6 months. I religiously read that. I'm in the commercial field, and there's a lot of stuff there that I can use. But that's it. The other one is that, again, the difference between Andrew and the other company is Times Microwave. I remember hearing something about that a couple of minutes ago. It's Times Microwave, and the secret is getting the right connector from the manufacturer for the cable. You're 100% right. The material that you were talking about, the red stuff, is red butyl rubber. been using the telephone company for many years.
Okay, good to know. Red Butyl Rubber. I'm writing that down. Gonna keep a keep an eye out for that particular material. Thank you, Mitch. Mr. HVR, give us your full set of call letters and your name, and then proceed with your question or comment. I'm K2RIW. My name is Dick.
Okay, good evening, Dick. The call is November 2, Hotel Victor Romeo. The name here is Nick. Just a little of the subject. I heard you mention one time that you could use, like, a cable that the cable company uses. I recently came across a bunch of cables that is used in cell sites. And it's 50-ohm cable. It's called Flex Plus. And it's like 3/8 diameter, you know, from the outer jacket, 3/8 of an inch in diameter. I was wondering, can that be utilized in ham radio? I know the connectors that are on the cable right now couldn't be used, but I guess they could be taken off and put other kinds of connectors on. I just want your opinion is on that stuff.
Without a doubt, any of these cables that are 50 or 70 ohms, I don't care what service they were intended for, all have a beautiful application to ham radio. Coax is coax. The coax, with rare exception, doesn't give a darn what frequency you're sending down there. The only slight exception to that is the 70-ohm hardline, 3/4-inch cable, they call it 750 cable, meaning 0.750 outside diameter. The 750 cable used by cable companies has a kind of foam-filled dielectric inside that works very well up to 1,000 megacycles and starts becoming very lossy beyond that. That was quite a surprise to me. The stuff has got very low loss to 1,000 megs, and at 1296, it's starting to show loss. And I was using it at 2.4 gigs, and at 2.4 gigs, its insertion loss was about four times higher in decibels than it was at 1,000 megs. So with that exception of that exotic material, a very inexpensive kind of foam that's got a sudden resonance of some kind at 2.4 gigs and above, with that exception, any cable you can get your hands on, hardline cable, should work beautifully for ham radio. Now, the connectors that are used for cell sites most likely are 716 DIN connectors. That really means, they call it 716 because I think it's 7 millimeters inside for the semiconductor and 16 millimeters for the outside connector. I think that's what it means. And it's a rather large, sturdy connector. And so, if you had a way of mating to those are very well-made connectors. To rip off that connector and put on something else that is more appropriate for your equipment, like type N's and BNC's and UHF and so on, you've got a little bit of a mechanical engineering problem of finding the right connector that mates with that diameter of cable. But even if you have to use plumbing fittings, and a lot of guys have done that. Let me drop. A lot of guys have found ways of using plumbing fittings to do an adaption. And until you get to the very high VHF, UHF frequencies, the plumbing adapter approach works rather well as long as you do a pretty good job of not making drastic changes in the inner and outer diameters and do a good job of weatherproofing. Some guys have come up with some pretty homely-looking homebrew connectors for the end of hardline. Despite their homeliness, they work very, very well. Another approach is that in the case of cable TV, the connectors that they manufacture for the end of their cable are called stinger connectors. It's made to mate with a box that contains the amplifier. It's got a 5/8-24 thread on the outside of the connector. It's a male with a long center conductor. And if you trim off the center conductor to the right length, solder on the center pin of your tight end connector, UG21, remove the nut off the back of your UG21 connector, and it screws directly onto the stinger with this rubber O-ring seal in there. Put some silicone lubricant on the rubber to make sure it gives you a better job of weatherproofing. Lots of guys have built a tight end connector on the end of the stinger connector that is used on CATV hardline. Came out with a very good operation. I've got quite a few of those on my tower. And although there's a big airspace inside, with good weatherproofing job, but they've worked very well for me over the years. Anybody with any further questions or comments, give me your call letters and name right now. K2RIW in the deck man.
2RSO again.
Mitch recognized. Anyone else?
N2RSO again.
Yeah, Mitch recognized. Anyone else?
It's Frank.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes, you're right. Frank, you got it. Go ahead.
Okay, Dick. Getting back to the Hinton's article, I think that that use of the PVC tubing and the silicone ceiling is analogous to what we used to do many years ago when splicing anything from a 22-gauge wire up to, I guess, around 12 or 14 or 12-gauge. And that was taking an ordinary drinking straw, placing that on the cable, sliding it back, actually it's not a cable, it's a single wire, twisting it, doing your soldering job on it, then sliding the straw back over and filling it with ordinary bathroom cork. Something we completely did, oh, I don't know, 10, 20 years ago before more sophisticated methods came out. Back to that N2RSO.
And let me ask you this, Frank. When you did this sealing with the straw and the caulking compound, and you first wrapped those wires together, was it a so-called Western Union splice-type wrapping procedure you did before you slipped over the straw and then put on the caulking compound? Did you use a Western Union twisting splice technique? Back to you, Frank.
The answer is yes.
And give us a couple of words on that. What is unique about the so-called Western Union splice? Tell us how to do a real good job of joining two pieces of wire end-to-end. You got it, Frank.
Well, with braided wire or twisted wire, it's just a matter of getting the proper length so that you achieve a good twist of one wire over the other. I usually did it manually and finished it off with a pair of pliers to flatten it down as much as possible and then insulate it. That's basically it. That is in fact the Western Union splice. By the way, my splicing was done years ago at Western Electric, so I was used to the Western Electric splice.
At Western Electric, did they call it the Western Electric splice, or did some of the guys call it the Western Union splice? Go ahead.
Nick, was so long ago, I really don't recall. Although they seem to frown upon splicing, they usually had a piece of placing the entire cable if they were breaking it. And of course, at that time, all of the excess cable, the copper, went into a bag for recycling, and hopefully they're doing the same thing today in the telephone company.
Occasionally you get some kind of damage that occurs from a backhoe or automobile accident or whatever, and one of these very many multi-conductor cables gets severed and has to be spliced. Would you happen to know what method of splicing and insulating is used when you've got one of these very many multi-connector cables, multi-conductor cables that have to be put back together? Now back to you, Frank.
Oh, I'm sorry, Dick. I was an inside man. I worked in installation of number 3 crossbar, number 5 crossbar, ANI, automatic number identification, which required wire wrap gun, and we also did the power work. The batteries ran on 48 volt DC, 20 volt AC for the receptacles in the telephone building, as they were known back then, central office. But no, I was not involved at all with outside cable work.
Tell you what they did, Dick, KEY.
Okay, thank you, Frank. Frank, you could use more audio. I'm saying it to quite a few people tonight. Mel, you've got it. And Mel, give us lots of audio.
Okay, what they used, I watched them do it, they got these little plastic clippers shoved a wire in each thing and then he squeezed it with this tool. And supposedly that's it, and then they put the boot over it. You know, they got this big boot usually that goes over that, like a half a thing is snapped open, you know. It's like, I don't know how to describe it. It looks like a clamshell, a long day's clamshell. Snapped closed, that boot, and then the end, you know, self-sealing on the end. And the whole mess of it is shoved into that boot. I watched them do it. It's just a simple little, a sort of round shape. They're not elongated, you know, they're not long like you would think. They're sort of round, and they shove the wire into these, and then it just squeezes together some way. And I guess it has integrity, because that seems to be the way they're doing it for a long time now, over.
They look like gumdrops, don't they?
Exactly.
So it looks like gumdrops, and then they got a fancy crimping tool. I guess it makes a very nice assembly of insulation, connecting, melding of the wire and whatever. Quite a process. I think we've gone down the list of everyone who signed in which case we're getting ready for the mailbag. Let me do a double check. Are we going down the list? Is there anyone else? Give us your call letters and name at this time.
KC2QIQ with comment.
Yeah, I may have forgotten you, Glenn. Go ahead, Glenn.
Hello, Doug. Let me run this one by you, but it was just kind of a strange observation, but I had coaxial cable used for cable vision at one time, where the connectors were inside the house. There was a line that ran outside the house and came back in through another section so that there were no connectors on the outside of the house. And that cable had been there for about 10 years. And after some time, the reception through that cable really started getting poor over the years. And after about 10 years, I guess, you know, siding was going to be put on the house and everything, we pulled the cable through. And just the rubble or insulation, after 10 years, that cable looked horrible. And I kind of, like, took a razor blade to the center of it, and it looked like moisture even got into the braiding on the inside and started to corrode the braiding. Now, there were no connectors external to the outside of the house at all. What do you think happened there? I couldn't blame that one on the connectors at all. Back to you there.
I can think of two things that can happen. If water got into the connector where the cable mates with the breakout box at the utility pole, and water will crawl down the inside of the cable very nicely, that's one way. And if they had a bad run of cable where the outer rubber jacket wasn't very weatherproof, didn't survive very long, developed a crack somewhere, maybe it had been pulled against the sharp object and it had a void in it. Whenever water gets into the cable and it starts mating with the braid, eventually terrible things happen, galvanic action and whatever. So it probably was a foam-filled cable, water that was degrading the foil, the braid was also degrading your reception of your dielectric, your foam-filled dielectric, making it a lot lossier. You can survive probably an extra 15 or 20 decibels of loss in the case of cable TV because they adjust that to be an extremely strong signal just for problems like that. So if you were starting to get yucky reception, I'll bet you had an extra 20 decibels of loss from end to end in that particular piece of cable, Glenn. Did you ever see the end that was closer to the utility pole? I'll bet you that's one of the places where water could have gotten in. Shout a little bit louder into your mic, Glenn. Back to you, Glenn. K2LIW.
Yeah, interestingly enough, you know, Cablevision would eventually do service every couple of years, and they would come down and they would fix the drop lines and other things to make sure that everything was okay. But what was odd about this one was that this was like an early part of the installation where the connector was on both ends, was inside the house, and the run of the wire was, I guess, just to go around the outside of the house, because they couldn't basically sneak cable through the house. They actually ran it that one section along the outside, but there were no connectors on the outside, so it really was odd. And when I looked at the connectors at the sets on both ends, the cable there looked fantastic. It was just where the cable exited the house on the outside. There really wasn't any void in the cable anyplace. It was just that, you know, you could see, like, the insulation was just starting to bubble, and, you know, it's just, I'm almost of the opinion that, I don't know, maybe it's a poor opinion, but just that, you know, the rubberized cable just has a light bowl on its own, where the rubber itself isn't going to be any kind of a hermetic seal after a certain number of years of weathering outdoors. Back over to you, Dick, KC2, QIQ.
2 hours,
though.
Yeah, Frank recognized, but let me first ask you this one. Your main drop from the utility pole to the house is a cable with a messenger, you know, a steel cable with it to give it some strength, and it's a particular color which is made to be weatherproofed. When it comes to the piece of cable that went from one portion of your house outside and back into your house again, I wonder if that was a piece of cable that was intended for indoor service. Was the outer jacket of that cable a different color than the cable that went from the utility pole to the house? Back to you, Glenn.
You know, Dick, I don't think it was. I think it was the same, only because back then, I mean, I haven't had cable vision in quite a few years, but at that time, it seemed like they used one cable for, like, everything, the drop cable, the cables inside the house. They all looked very, very similar. It was a black cable on the outside with foil, and it had the braiding on top of the foil, then it was a foam inside, and then copper through the center, which was a very typical cable that Cablevision used years ago. I don't know what they're doing now, if they're doing anything different. I have Fios now, but at the time, they would normally stop by, like, every few years and do adjustments and replace cables and things to improve service from time to time. But I never did notice a difference between cables. But I do know that Cablevision did have to, at least within at least a five-year period, have to replace the drop at one time. Back to you, then.
Okay, this particular piece of cable that degraded, what's your guess as to how long it had been installed in your house? Glenn, go ahead.
Oh, this had been in there about 10 years, Dick, and it was at the point where it wasn't being used anymore. It started having problems after about 5 years, and it said what really drove the whole idea of pulling it loose and removing it from the house was I was actually re-siding the house. So at that time, that's when I pulled it off, and it was, at that point, it wasn't in service any longer.
Okay, we've had two other people sign in. I think one of those was Frank. Go ahead, Frank.
Yeah, okay, Dick. I think that Cablevision is no longer doing that. I've found that every couple of years, I've had to call them to come down to replace the drop line. Anytime I see a degradation in my signal. It's very important to do this for one specific reason, more so than damage to the cable from rain. You've got RF leakage in both directions. I had a situation where I was picking up some call signs and tracked it down to a ham block away, and I thought he was causing it until I realized it was my drop line. More importantly is the fact that the RF leakage, especially on aviation frequencies, can interfere, and the FAA does not look fondly upon this. I know at one time Cablevision used to send their technicians around to check for leakage, but with the cuts today, I don't know if they're still doing it. I hope they are, but I still call for a new drop line every few years. Back to that.
That's a good thing to do, Frank. And yes, they have a very strict FAA rule they have to meet, which is called the Cumulative Leakage Index, CLI. And each individual piece of cable of their system is only allowed a certain amount of leakage, because when it's all added together for an aircraft that's looking down on that whole town all at once, because those frequencies are reused on FAA frequencies, it can create quite a bit of grief. Let's see, there was another person who signed in. Who is that other person? Thought of it, your call letters and your name, sir. K2RIW, my name is Dick. Okay, I thought there was another person. I think we've gone through the whole list. I think it's time to go to the mailbag. K2KEY, K2RIW.
WW with a final comment.
Yeah, go ahead, Howie.
You want to put Scotch coat or something on the around when you finally do the connection so you protect it from UV. I've usually used Scotch coat. I paint that over the splice or the tape. Go ahead. You know, I do it. I put the tape on first, then put the sealant in there, you know, the cold shrink or whatever, then black tape, and then I put Scotch coat or Scotch guard that protects the connection from the sunlight.
My chest out. Yeah, now, Rust-Oleum makes a kind of a spray which is known to be an ultraviolet protecting spray. Does Scotch coat specifically claim ultraviolet protection, Howie?
Absolutely. You get that from Tesco.
Okay, that's good. Was that Joe that was making another comment? Okay, I don't know who that was. Okay, K2KEY. I think it's time to go to the mailbag. We've got time to get through a few of them tonight, Mel. K2LAW.
Okay, this is K2KEY. So if somebody else wants to make a comment, I don't want to forget about, you know, pass over someone. Somebody asked a comment, so take one more standby and see if anyone wants to say anything about any of the above, and then I'll go on with the mailbag, because I try to stay with the subject, then it makes things a lot easier. Go ahead, anyone else who wants to make the comments, and then we'll pick it up from here. This is K2KEY, the tech man.
It could have been somebody who was just listening and signing in, Mel. And give us enough audio and go right ahead, Mel.
Okay, very good. This is K2KEY. All right. So I started pulling them out here. As I said, I went to the ham fest today, Limehouse Ham Fest. Sort of quiet. Wasn't really a big turnout, nor was there a heck of a lot to see. You know, a lot of odds and ends. But it was a nice day, so we figured take a little ride. I thought maybe we'd run into you there. Had a nice talk with Andy and a few other people who complimented us on the TechNet. Let's see, I'm going to drop it and I'll read the first one.
Yeah, I'm sorry about that, Mel. I kind of thought that you might go there and you might be looking for me, and I didn't get a chance to go. I had something else I had to do this morning, and I guess if I was a real nice guy, as soon as I found out I wasn't going to be able to make it, I should have called you up. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Okay, no problem, Dick. I was just taking a ride anyhow. Just to, you know, break up the the routine and do some other routine with radio HI. So it doesn't make a difference. Was somebody going to make a comment just now, or will I go on?
I think there's no one making a comment, and you got the floor.
I saw somebody just kept saying something. All right, maybe I... in a recent... this is a question. You know, I've gotten interested in antennas for receiving, as you fellas have talked about. However, recently I read that a beverage antenna near the ocean is not an effective antenna. Is anything... Why is this? I also have seen that DX expeditions that go to islands and all, and they're surrounded by water, found that there's no reason to erect a beverage antenna for receiving that. They found that they do not work well. What is the reason why beverage will not work near an ocean, Dick? Over.
Yeah, that's a new one on me. And I'm having trouble believing that seawater, which makes an extremely good ground plane over the beverage antenna, why that wouldn't work quite well. Now, for a beverage antenna to work well, it's got to be a significant number of wavelengths long into a usually 600 ohm terminating resistor, which is itself going into a good grounding system, maybe even some counterpoise radials on it. I think a little bit of the problem could be that when you're going to a temporary installation and putting islands on the air or whatever, you don't have the right starting conditions. You're not going through all the fine details of the installation. These are some guesses on my part. I don't know of a reason why beverage should work near seawater. But that's something for further investigation. I've never done it. I'm just going by what I think is the theory of operation of a beverage. It is a traveling wave antenna like a rhombic. The method of operation of a beverage and the method of operation of a rhombic is very similar. Are we also going to say that a rhombic antenna doesn't work well near a seashore? I will admit that the major antennas that were set up at Radio Central in Rocky Point were rhombic antennas. And if the frequencies that they were using, portions of the Rocky Point installation were not very far from the sea, from the North Shore. Well, maybe they were a mile or two, so it's not quite the same. But if a beverage antenna doesn't work well near a seashore, my next question is, does a rhombic work well? Because I think the theory of operation is quite similar. K2KEY, K2RIW.
No, I don't know the answer. This is K2KEY either. In fact, I just dug out the article. I thought I also thumbed through it. And this is in the QSP June issue. And it says here about, you know, DX expeditions, going on DX expeditions. And these people that are very experienced DX expedited, like ON4UN, he's one of the top DXers. And it says here, in fact, a number of them have said it is, quote, it is the accepted wisdom that beverage receive antennas do not work by the ocean. We have tried our previous DX expedition on a number of without any success. And as far as we are concerned, the beverage does not work at all over anywhere near salt water. Now, this is, confirms the observations made by Ben Mueller, Ben Mueller, OZ8DV, and a number of VK0IR Heard Island Expedition, and a whole bunch of them seem to confirm that. They all did this experiment to see if they can dig out the signals, especially on like 80 meters, you know, from these hard places to work, you know, under the propagation. So looking for a great antenna or some good receiving antenna, usually you think of a beverage, but there they are. They confirmed that they've made these tests a number of times at different locations on these islands and areas, and found the beverage is not the antenna. Over.
Okay. Yeah, person with comment, I'm going to pass it over to you in a second. But my first question is, when they say it doesn't work well, does that mean they weren't able to hear the signal? Weren't getting very much S-meter deflection? As if they had a lot of attenuation going on somewhere, and somehow the seawater was doing that? Or was the antenna picking up a whole lot of noise, atmospheric noise, or whatever, man-made noise locally, and from their generator, and therefore they weren't hearing well because of lousy signal-to-noise ratio? So, I mean, the antenna not working, there's two or three different ways it could not work. It's firing in the wrong direction. It's got an antenna pattern that was different than anticipated. I mean, they aimed... A beverage antenna gives you a certain angle off of the wire where it peaks up. And maybe that angle off of the wire changes as a function of the velocity of propagation of the material that's underneath the beverage wire itself. So maybe they calculated the angle wrong. So is it wrong angle of reception, wrong front-to-back ratio, not the right amount of signal, or lousy signal-to-noise ratio and picking up a whole lot of excess noise? Four or five ways the antenna can fail. I'd like to know what method of failure it had. Didn't give them the right standing wave ratio. Person who said comment, please give us your call letters and your name, and go right ahead with your comment. My name is Dick. Glenn recognized. After the first person that said comment, go ahead, comment.
Okay, Dick, good evening. W2VOB, Bob, and... I have a comment regarding your description of the RCA station at Rocky Point. That was transmit only. They had a separate receive facility in Riverhead, and they had many miles of receiving antennas in that area. I was chief engineer at a radio station in Riverhead, and we, on our FCC license, we had a stipulation that we were not going to interfere with the RCA transmitting station's reception. So the comment about being next to the ocean with beverage or rhombic antennas in that particular case does not hold true. Back to you, Dick.
Okay, so I think you're saying, Bob, that you're fairly sure that the Riverhead receiving site, which also is near a body of water and salt water by, for that matter, I think you're saying you believe it works at the receiving site, which were either beverage or rhombic antennas. I think you're saying you have reason to believe they worked correctly. Is that true, Bob? Go ahead.
Yes, that's affirmative, Dick. K2GMF, a good friend of mine, worked for RCA at the Rocky Point station, and I did go to visit him while I was working in Riverhead, and he described the whole facility to me, and the Riverhead facility was their main and only, as far as I can tell, their only receiving point for RCA telecommunications, which was basically CW and RIDI. And the facility itself was less than a mile from Teutonic Bay, which of course is emptying into the Atlantic Ocean. So it did work fine for them, and they were a major corporation, so that's the way it is. Back to you, Dick.
RSO recognized. Bob, I wonder if you heard that there was a beautiful presentation that was given at Symbol/Motorola 2 weeks ago by Mr. Lundquist, who used to work there, and also was supported by George Flanagan and W2KRM. A presentation about what Radio Central was like and what the early days of radio were like. I wonder, Bob, if you had a chance to be invited to that particular presentation. I unfortunately wasn't able to make it. I was very disappointed. Back to you, Bob.
Okay, Dick. No, negative. I was not aware of it. After I left CBS, I worked for CBS Radio and Television for 28 years. So, at any rate, going from small time to big time, but I was not aware of that particular ceremony, Dick. Back to you.
Okay, now we've got a number of people who signed in. Glenn was the first one. Go ahead, Glenn.
Yeah, interestingly enough, Dick, last year at during field day, I was experimenting with a lot of antennas that I wanted to bring with me down to Jones Beach. So I spent most of my field day down there, and I originally was setting up a lot of antennas in my backyard. Now, where I live, I'm only like less than a quarter of a mile from from the bay, so I'm really, really close to the water. And all the antennas I tried in my backyard, they worked, fairly well. I mean, I'm not going to say they're perfect because I wasn't experimenting with them all that high off the ground, maybe 10 feet, 5 feet, different areas with dipoles and other things like that. When I brought them down to the beach, I found that they worked really, really poor. They tuned up well. It could be a CBR when I was setting them up there at the field four, right in the sand, but they were like dummy loads. They really worked horrible. The antennas seemed to work phenomenal with anything vertical. Vertical on the back of my Jeep, that was even in the parking lot, carrying off little antennas, Yagis, anything I could put on a tripod and hang on the beach there. Absolutely worked fantastic. But most of the stuff that I was using was horizontal wire antennas that worked well in my backyard. When I got down to the beach, I'm not sure why that is, but they just didn't seem to perform well at all.
When you don't have a significant altitude of the installation, and you've got a very good conductor underneath it, I think your antenna becomes a nevus antenna, near vertical incident sky wave. In other words, 90-some-odd% of the wave is going straight up and very little out to the horizon. That could be a factor on what these T-Expeditions are running into. So low altitude, horizontally polarized antennas are going to give them some grief with a good conducting surface nearby. That's a guess on my part. I'm not sure. I'm not an HF-er. There was another person who wanted to make a comment. Who was that?
Frank, or so.
Go right ahead, Frank.
Nick, I have a question from Mel. I'm wondering if that article possibly was meant to be humorous or even facetious, because when first mentioned what the offense was, I laughed because I had a picture in my mind of someone taking the end of this beverage antenna, which was probably 200-300 feet long and a 600 ohm resistor, and swimming out over the water for 200 to 300 feet and looking for a mast or something to secure it to. I mean, it just doesn't work.
Yeah, if you don't have the 600 ohm terminating resistor, it doesn't stop your beverage from having the gain in that direction. It just fires in both directions. The 600 ohm resistor gives you directivity, gives you a front-to-back ratio. So without the 600 ohm resistor, the antenna still works. So even if you didn't do a good job of that, I don't think that alone should stop it from working. But I'm thinking the seawater gives you a different velocity of propagation, gives you different angles, gives you a different sky wave-like phenomena. I'm guessing some of these are some of the variables. Let's see what Mel's got to say. K2KEY, K2LIW.
Dick, my point was, at what point can you secure this antenna if you're over the ocean? I mean, unless there's a boat out there waiting for you, or someone has put in a mast deep enough to go into the earth below the water. What do you do with it? Do you just stand there and hold it in your hand?
Yeah, very good point, Frank. Maybe what you're saying is the 400 feet of wire was a catenary that came down and almost touched the water, even if they did have a support for the far end. And did they have enough water support at the intermediate point? But this is some of the mechanical engineering problems you maybe are indicating. Is that true, Frank?
No, I'm just wondering if the article was meant to be humorous, that the reason it didn't work was they couldn't find someone with enough stamina to swim out that far in the ocean.
Okay, that's possible. Back to you, Mel. What do you think?
This is all seriousness. This is K2KY. This is a number of CX expeditions. And what they were usually thought originally, that they would be attracted to the beverage antennas, because I've known a number of people that have installed beverage antennas and they're fairly close to ground. They would just put them up high enough so somebody can come by and strangle themselves with it. Had a friend upstate put it about, he had 1,000 feet of wire hanging from tree limbs, no more than maybe 10 feet or so above ground, and that thing really worked fantastically well. In fact, it terminated the resistor, basically talking on handy talkies with an adjustable carbon rheostat, and just adjusted it to optimum performance. So, no, they were stringing them. They figured they could string them on these DX expeditions in many cases, from palm tree to palm tree or whatever. But I've heard this comment before, that the antennas, a lot of horizontal antennas, do not perform well near the ocean, even after they raise them up. But I can say a beverage is basically intended to work at very low altitudes in almost every installation I've seen them, Dick.
Yeah, I'm going to guess that the very low altitude and a very high conductor gave them very little signal on the horizon, a near vertical incident skywave problem. As the conductivity of the ground goes lower and lower, you end up with more and more signal on the horizon with a low antenna. And that signal on the horizon essentially nulls out when the antenna is low and the conductivity of the ground is high. That's a guess. And if you're a de-expedition, you may discover that the Nevis would give you great contact over very short ranges, like if you were talking to somebody on the same island. That would be a gangbuster antenna. But for a DX operation, that's not what you're looking for. Therefore, maybe they didn't recognize that characteristic. That's a guess on my part. And eventually, I guess we'll do a little more research and see if we can, all of us, we'll see if we can confirm this. Interesting set of comments. Back to you, Mel.
This is K2KE1. Well, like I say, I have had the experience with beverage. And one beverage antenna, boy, it was a one heck of a receiving antenna.
on 80 meters. What you would hear on it, unfortunately, they couldn't hear us because you can't transmit on the beverage antenna. But the antenna using we use for transmitting a number of different versions of it, unless somebody had a beverage on the other end for receiving, they would not hear you. But you'd be amazed when you have a beverage antenna like on 80 meters that's wavelength and wavelength long, what you will hear in the right location. And the right location seems to be in the wood sticks, not at the ocean side, over.
Okay. Now, I've got enough property now. I can only put up 550 feet of beverage. That's my longest dimension. To the east. Anything to the east? Yeah. Just about dead east or a little bit south of east. I could, in theory, set up a 500-foot long beverage, or it would be interesting to do this 80-meter purely vertical dipole set at the bottom, or maybe set in the middle, and start experimenting with the sloper angle. Maybe this summer I'll try that. What do you believe is the minimum length of a beverage for 80 meters to get any reasonable performance, Mel? And maybe if I was using a beverage on 20 meters, 500 feet would be enough. K2KUI, K2RIW.
The minimum that they usually recommend, nothing under 512 feet of wire. In other words, a good rule of thumb, like two wavelengths approximately on 80 meters. But, you know, it's funny. Most of the DX expeditions, originally, I always said to myself, well, I guess they put verticals and Yagis and things like that, stay away from other kinds of antennas because of maybe a convenience of stringing them, maybe, different reasons. But like Glenn said, I have experienced that too. You get an antenna that a lot of I finally boiled it down to what antennas and what heights work at our field day, where we are. And you find that certain antennas work better than others, Dick. It's amazing that you're just moving the location, sometimes a matter of miles, and you go from, an antenna, you say, gee, you try out your home QTH, and it's great. You take it to a place not far away, a matter of miles, and it's a lousy antenna. Go figure that out. I mean, yes, something, I can tell you, something with the terrain, and who the heck really knows what is going on? You wouldn't think such dreads would change it, in short distances. So go ahead. Comment.
Go ahead with comment. Start with your call letters and then your name, sir.
Yeah, it's Frank again in Juarez. So I'm reminded of an interesting experiment conducted by a fellow ham in, I believe it was Wisconsin. He loved to experiment with the SGC antenna couplers, and was very successful when he ran across an old railroad spur that ran approximately a mile or a mile and a half. Obviously, it was unused, and bushes and things, but he was able to put a clamp on one track connected to his SGC coupler and claims to have gotten excellent results. Now, I don't know what the takeoff angle was, whether he considered excellent as an NDIS antenna or whether he was able to do DX, but if anyone's near an abandoned railroad track, it's an interesting experiment to try. It's probably the longest beverage type of antenna you can find.
So if I understand you correctly, Frank, he's taking a long length of railroad track, one of those tracks, he clamps the signal onto it, which really means he's firing it both to the north and to the south, so to speak. I presume he establishes a local ground rod, and then his coax cable goes between those two. He fed it, and I think he's saying it made a moderately good antenna. Part of the reason I can see for that is that the railroad track has this beautiful stone bed, which is very non-conducting material, particularly if it hasn't rained recently. that stone bed that a railroad track almost always has is, 5 or 10 feet above the average terrain. So that can make a very nice beverage antenna with nice local insulation. So is that approximately the way you think he said it, Frank? Go ahead.
Yes, I believe so. In fact, I remember his call sign. It was November 9, Zulu Romeo Tango. He used to call himself N9 Zesty Red Tomato.
How about that? That's something to try. I know where there's a local railroad track that's been abandoned, not very close to my house, but some portable equipment could be brought there. K2KEY, KQRIW.
Okay, this is K2KEY. Yeah, that's what they make the claim of the beverage, that if you can put a beverage a couple feet above ground, you know, I could say 4 or 5 feet above ground, if it was practical, you could have an excellent beverage antenna. Of course, most people have to raise it up, you know, a bit of a distance up, so that, like, I don't think they want to trip somebody or strangle somebody, you know, decapitate somebody, so they raise them up. But if you have something like a bed, you know, the track bed, the stone bed and everything, and raise the track up a few feet and sits on that, I would say no doubt that rails are going to make an excellent beverage antenna. So, again, it's the location, and I don't know, again, I can't answer this question, why does the beverage work equally well on an island surrounded by salt water? This, I can't give a direct answer to either, Nick. Over.
KQ2QIQ with a quick comment.
You got it, Glenn.
Just a quick thing about Long Island, as far as trying to tune up to a railroad track, please don't do it here on Long Island, because they do actually, those tracks are pretty well insulated, and they actually send digital signals and DC signals down those lines to control the traffic controllers that control the arms going up and down, and there's also other measurements that they determine where the trains are along the track, so please don't try to transmit to the track in KQ2QIQ.
Might also cause RF burns if someone's sitting on at the track half a mile down the road.
It might not be that bad. By the time you get half a mile, I'd like to believe the signal is quite well attenuated. But you got a good point. Don't choose an active track for a bunch of reasons. Choose a really abandoned track. Back to you, Mel.
Hey, very interesting experiments and all. Unfortunately, I do not have any track here, nor do I have any area where I'm going to be able to string a wire that length and all, but I always was fascinated by beverage antennas and was able to see a number of them in operation, and I will say for receiving properly terminated, you can't beat a beverage antenna. I've worked with a number of people that have had one, both strung both, you know, to take care of the north, south, and west corridors, and amazing what they'll tell you. And after a while, you know, first you'll doubt, you know, some of their claims, but I have a feeling that, you know, they're not all exaggerating, Dick. All right, shall we go on?
We got the time to get two or three more if we're lucky.
Okay, I'm looking. And that's what I got here. Antenna questions and antenna questions, just one after another. You started to explain optimum elevation and angle, takeoff angle. I don't understand, what are you talking about? Different degrees and all different on different bands. All right, that's, I don't know if we tackle that. I don't know if I can give an easy answer to that. There's a little on the complicated side how the takeoff angles through different places vary from band to band. But that is a factor in actually if you want to, you know, have an antenna system that you particularly want to favor different places. You know, for instance, quickly, like the optimum takeoff angle to Europe from my location on 75 meters is 20 degrees.
and it's, if you go to 40 meters, it's a different factor. But can you maybe simply explain optimum takeoff angle, Dick? Over.
I think I can. At least I can for horizontally polarized antennas. For vertically polarized antennas, I'm not so sure. But for a horizontally polarized antenna, you've got a real wave radiated by the antenna, and you've got a ground-bound wave. As far as your horizontally polarized antenna is concerned, the Earth that's under it is a